This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with New Yorker staff writer Evan Osnos. When Donald Trump announced his candidacy, Osnos was reporting on extremist white rights groups. What Osnos quickly discovered and wrote about for The New Yorker was that Trump's anti-immigration message was resonating with these groups. Osnos writes, quote, "Ever since the Tea Party's peak in 2010 and its fade, citizens on the American far right, patriot militias, border vigilantes, white supremacists, have searched for a standard bearer, and now they've found him. In the past, white nationalists, as they called themselves, had described Trump as a Jew lover, but the new tone of his campaign was a revelation," unquote. Let's start with a clip from Trump's June 16th speech announcing his candidacy. These comments about Mexicans are an example of what sparked the approval of many white nationalists.
The U.S. has become a dumping ground for everybody else's problems. It's true. And these are the best and the finest. When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people. But I speak to border guards, and they tell us what we're getting.
Well, that was Donald Trump. Evan Osnos, welcome to Fresh Air. You were covering white nationalist groups at the time that Trump announced his candidacy. So when the groups that you were talking with, the groups that you were covering, heard what we just heard Trump say, what was the reaction they had?
Well, this was the surprise for me, and I think it was a surprise to them, too. When they heard Donald Trump talk about, as he put it, Mexico sending criminals across the border, as he said, there were rapists, they're bringing drugs, and so on, that concept, that image that he was generating, mapped very closely onto their ideas. And so 12 days after Donald Trump announced his candidacy, the Daily Stormer, which is the largest neo-Nazi news site in America, endorsed him for president. And it said to its readers, "We generally do not take a position in politics. We don't think politics has anything for us. But Donald Trump is saying the right things. He's talking about things in a way that we agree with. And for that reason, we're throwing our support behind him." And that, for me, was a signal that something was going on that I hadn't anticipated.
I want to read a quote from your article in The New Yorker, and this is a quote from Richard Spencer, who runs a white racial consciousness think tank. And he said to you, "I don't think Trump is a white nationalist," but he told you that he does think that Trump reflected a, quote, "unconscious vision that white people have, that their grandchildren might be a hated minority in their own country. I think that scares us. They probably aren't able to articulate it. I think it's there. I think that, to a degree, explains the Trump phenomenon. I think he is the one person who can tap into it," unquote. So he's saying here, like, Trump might not be a white nationalist. He's probably not a white nationalist. He might not endorse us, but he's tapping into this feeling that so many of us have. Do you think that he is empowering white nationalists?
He is. He's giving them a sign, a kind of permission that their ideas have a broader audience than they might have imagined. And it's worth being clear. You know, I think that the ideas that somebody like Richard Spencer endorses and that other members of these self-identified white nationalist groups endorse, those ideas really are repellent to most people. And that's a generalization, but I think a fair one, and I can sort of defend that. What is going on beneath it, and one of the reasons why I think it's even worth talking about what these guys believe, is that they are, in some sense, the most acute public expression of an anxiety that exists in lesser form on a much broader basis. And so, you know, Richard Spencer, in saying that, what he's getting at is the sense that there are people, and I encountered this in half a dozen states as I went around talking to people, and I would say, well, what is your number one issue? What's the thing that you care about most of all? And people would say over and over, I care about immigration. I'm afraid that, as they put it, illegals are coming into this country and taking our jobs and sucking our country dry. And what surprised me about it was that this was in places where the idea of immigration, the actual practical effects of it, are very remote, very abstract. I was in New Hampshire, for instance, and walked up to somebody at a diner. Immigration was what they said was the biggest thing on their minds. Immigration, of course, in New Hampshire is it's not something that you see every day. It's not like talking about it in Texas, where people have a much more explicit sense of it.
So do you think part of the anxiety that some white people in America are feeling are because of the demographic predictions that by 2040, white people will be in a minority in the U.S.?
Yeah, there is this very clear sense, and you hear this this concept floating around in the white nationalist crowd, is that by the middle of this century, so demographers predict somewhere around 2042, that non-Hispanic whites will no longer be the largest ethnic racial group in America. And that moment has taken on a symbolic power for people who feel that they're losing influence. And you know, beneath all of this, there is a real economic phenomenon going on, and that's that particularly men, low-skilled men without much of an education, have in many ways fallen out of step with America's economic progress. You see this reflected in the numbers very clearly, that if you're a man without a college degree, that your income over the last 30 years has dropped by about 20% in real terms, whereas for women, it has gained about 3%. And so if you're somebody in that position and you look around and you see your own world as dwindling and shrinking and your opportunities are falling away, well, then you're looking for an explanation. And in some ways, Donald Trump has provided that explanation.
And Evan, let me stop here and ask you, we're using the word white nationalist as opposed to the word white supremacist. Why are we using white nationalists? It's the word you use in your article.
Yeah, it's a subtle distinction. The difference is that historically, white supremacist groups believed fundamentally in the idea that one race was superior above all, and that was essential to their ideology. This grew out of slavery and the legacy of it. White nationalist groups believe something slightly different. They believe, in fact, that whites are an endangered species these days, and they say that they're not standing up for one race over another, they're standing up for the preservation of their community. You struggle as a writer, certainly, and we did at the magazine, about whether or not to call these groups white supremacist groups or white nationalist groups, and there are times where I go back and forth. I think we're certainly not captive to what it is that they want to be called themselves. They prefer to be called white nationalists. Some of them don't even embrace that term. They want to be called identitarians or other things. But the terminology in some ways can be a bit of a disguise from the fact that there's an enduring element of this, which is a sort of race-based division that is at the essence of their beliefs, and that hasn't changed. But there is a distinction going on that's subtle, and I think the subtle distinction is important because it captures that they don't feel strong today. In fact, they feel weak, and that's what being a white nationalist is about, is about the sense that, as they put it, we're facing a cultural genocide. That's a term that they use over and over again.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Evan Osnos, and he's a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he covers politics and foreign affairs. And he recently wrote an article about how Donald Trump has been catching on in white nationalist groups. And I want to play another example of Donald Trump playing on the sphere of Mexicans and Mexico. And this is from the Republican debate that Fox News hosted. Chris Wallace had asked Trump what proof he has that Mexico is sending their criminals to the U.S. And here's what Trump had to say.
Because our leaders are stupid, our politicians are stupid, and the Mexican government is much smarter, much sharper, much more cunning, and they send the bad ones over because they don't want to pay for them, they don't want to take care of them. Why should they when the stupid leaders of the United States will do it for them? And that's what's happening, whether you like it or not.
Evan Osnos, does that inject an element of conspiracy theory into this too? It's like not only are the bad guys coming across the border, but the government is intentionally sending them. They're intentionally dumping them here.
Well, this is a version of an argument that Donald Trump has made for decades. In fact, if you go back and you look to what he was saying in the late 1980s, because he started talking about running for president in 1987, and he never did it, of course, until recently. But back then, he ran ads in the newspaper, full-page ads in three newspapers that said that Japan, which at that point, of course, was a U.S. ally, remains a U.S. ally, was taking advantage of the United States, that we were the laughingstock around the world. And it's quite striking how similar the language is from that period to what he now says about the way that other countries, whether it's Mexico or China, or he still talks about Japan, which seems a little bit of an antique reference these days. I don't think of Japan as being a source of great American economic concern. But he uses that sense that we should be embarrassed because others are organizing effectively against us. And I hear in that language something so interesting and different about politics, because oftentimes what people say is Donald Trump reminds me a bit of Ronald Reagan. And there is something to that, the sense that he's a performer, that he has figured out what people want to hear and that he's brilliant in front of the camera and so on. But the difference between what Ronald Reagan was saying, which was a fundamentally, in some level, a fundamentally optimistic message about his image of the United States and what it could be, is very different from what Donald Trump says. Donald Trump has a mantra of despair, of loss. He says, we don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't. And he says, the American dream is dead. And it's that combination of being both almost audaciously confident in himself and in the image that he projects about himself, while also saying things that are enormous, that are truly bleak about America's future, that seems to have combined into a recipe that people respond to because they feel frustrated in their own lives and they want to find somebody else who will give that form.
So we've been talking about how Trump's message is resonating among white nationalists. You happen to be covering white nationalists at the time that Trump announced his candidacy. So you were there to see the reaction. But you're not saying that Trump's base is white nationalists, that people who support Trump are necessarily white nationalists.
We're not saying by any means that every Trump supporter is a white nationalist. In fact, what you see, Trump has this vast range of different kinds of supporters. You know, he's leading in all of the categories of Republican voters. So he leads among men, he leads among women, he leads among moderate Republicans, and he leads among conservative Republicans. But what you see when you drill down on the numbers is that the broad majority of his support comes from two pools. And one pool are Americans without a college degree, and the other pool are Americans who feel that immigration threatens the future of the country. And so it's worth saying very clearly that there are people who support Donald Trump for a whole variety of very powerful and legitimate reasons, because he is a rebuke to politics, because he is entertaining, he's fun to watch, because they recognize him from television. And then there is this other segment, and that segment is out on the far right. It includes white nationalists and others. And that's a group that has responded to him in ways that it hasn't responded to any politician in a very long time.
You spent some time looking into Donald Trump's past. Did you find anything there that helps you understand the things that he's saying now?
Well, there's a natural temptation, I think, to want to understand the psychology of Donald Trump. Why does he do what he does? I, at one point, decided early on, in fact, in the research, that was really not a very fruitful way to go, because I think Donald Trump himself, he lives an unexamined life. And for me to try to impose some complicated psychological explanation for it probably wouldn't get me very far. It was more interesting, perhaps more useful, to talk about the effect that he produces. That being said, there are some very clear things. When you go back and you look at his life, one of the things that comes through very clearly is that Donald Trump was born to great privilege. We all know that he's the son of a very successful New York real estate developer, Fred Trump. But in Donald Trump's story, in the details of his story, there's a distinction, which is that Donald Trump was grew up, of course, in Queens. His father was an enormously successful businessman who built all over the city. And when Trump was growing up, he really regarded his father as a great developer in Brooklyn and Queens. But Manhattan, that was the promised land. That was off limits. That's his father never went into Manhattan. He never built there. He never succeeded there. And in the earliest interviews, when you read about what Donald Trump thought about himself and his own future, he sensed that he was going to be the one to bring the Trump name not only to Manhattan, but to everything that would imply to him, which is a kind of success, inclusion. And so as a young man, he went out, he moved to Manhattan, he joined social clubs in New York, for instance, that an earlier generation would have excluded him from. And so he made, and you see that today, that in his representation of himself, he is almost a cartoonish representation of what it means to be a New York real estate tycoon.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Evan Osnos. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker, where he covers politics and foreign affairs. And he's recently been writing about how Donald Trump's anti-immigration message has been resonating among white nationalists. You've also written about China for years. You were based in Beijing for several years. You've written books about China, many articles about China. So I want to play one of Donald Trump's messages about China. And this comes from his announcement that he was running for president. And he was talking about how the U.S. doesn't know how to work with China.
Our country is in serious trouble. We don't have victories anymore. We used to have victories, but we don't have them. When was the last time anybody saw us beating, let's say, China in a trade deal? They kill us. I beat China all the time. All the time.
Okay, Evan Osnos, you covered China for a long time. Do you know anything about what kind of business deals Donald Trump made with China? Like, what does he mean when he says he beat China all the time?
Yeah, he hasn't really specified. And I have to tell you, I don't think Donald Trump is regarded in China as a frequent visitor or somebody who really has a lot of business over there. He's talked about the fact that he has sold apartments in New York City, very, very high-end apartments, to Chinese buyers. But I think he's getting at something which is in its own way, it's not even very specific to his business. What he's talking about is this sense that America is losing in the world today. And he says the world is a place of winners and losers. Losers is, of course, one of his favorite insults. And he sometimes applies it to us. And he says we are losing in the world today. And he recognized, I think quite rightly, that when people look overseas and they try to understand who it is that's potentially going to rival the United States as a power in the world, that China is first on the list.
I want to turn to another Donald Trump clip. And this was him at a press conference recently in Las Vegas before giving a speech there. And he was talking about negotiating with China.
When these people walk in the room, they don't say, "Oh, hello, how's the weather? It's so beautiful outside. Isn't it lovely? How are the Yankees doing? Oh, they're doing wonderful. Great." They say, "We want deal."
Well, that's Donald Trump. So, Evan Osnos, do you have any idea how the Chinese leadership is reacting to the things that Trump is saying about China?
Well, initially, they really weren't taking it all that seriously because they've learned over the years that American political seasons tend to produce an uptick in this sort of nationalist rhetoric, and they don't really worry all that much historically. I have to say, though, that recently they've gotten more concerned, partly because of the things that Donald Trump is saying. For instance, he said that when the Chinese president Xi Jinping comes to the United States in September, that the U.S. shouldn't give him a state visit. In fact, they should just take him to McDonald's and give him a Big Mac. But it's not just Donald Trump's comments. They've also heard Scott Walker, for instance, who is, of course, another candidate for the Republican nomination. He has been talking about taking a much harsher line on China. So has Marco Rubio. That they're beginning to see that Donald Trump even though he may or may not be the nominee, that he has already pulled the Republican field in a direction of a much more confrontational stance towards China. And so for that reason, Chinese leaders are definitely taking notice.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer for The New Yorker, who covers politics and foreign affairs. You can hear a longer version of his conversation with Terry on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair. If you spent a few minutes thinking about the places you've worked over the years, you could probably recall a few people who somehow made the people around them better. They might not be the most talented, but they'd boost morale, collaborate on projects, share knowledge, and pitch in when help is needed. Our next guest, veteran baseball writer Lonnie Wheeler, says Major League Baseball teams are beginning to recognize the value of such intangibles in players they acquire. While the statistical analysis of players, dramatized in the film Moneyball, guides many decisions, Wheeler says there's more to what makes a player valuable. In his new book, Intangible, Wheeler writes that players who work hard, set good examples, mentor other players, and create a positive clubhouse atmosphere can make teams better in ways that are easier to see than they are to measure. Lonnie Wheeler is a former newspaper writer and columnist who's also ghostwritten several books with athletes, including three who've been on Fresh Air, Reggie Jackson, Bob Gibson, and Mike Piazza. We spoke with him in August. Lonnie Wheeler, welcome to Fresh Air. You say there are two kinds of intangibles, situational intangibles and environmental intangibles. First, what are situational intangibles?
Those are the things that you can see on the field. A batter hitting behind a runner to advance an extra base, maybe taking a pitch so a runner can steal a base, you know, an outfielder calling a fly ball, you know, so there's not a collision, backing up another outfielder who may be charged with an error if the second fellow doesn't get there and save him of that. You know, the little things that people refer to are basically the situational intangibles, and those can be, and to some extent now are, being measured. They're not generally input into a player's bottom line statistically, but they're not being ignored.
So that's situational intangibles. What are environmental intangibles?
Mostly it's the things that people can't see that may go on in the dugout, in the off season, in the clubhouse. It's players, by whatever means, making other players better through counsel, through example, work ethic. It's a social thing. It's players rubbing off on each other, playing well with others, creating a culture, an atmosphere that is conducive specifically to winning. It's not necessarily creating a kind and gentle environment where everybody's getting along and having a good time. Sometimes it's what's required is some tough love or some harsh words.
Right. So there are times that it involves a player making another player better in a clear way by giving some advice or calling them out or giving them an example. There's also the question of clubhouse leadership. And early in the book, you write about the Cincinnati Reds of some years ago when they had two terrific stars, Ken Griffey Jr., wonderful ball player, great outfielder, had a sweet swing that would hit ball out of the park, and then Adam Dunn, who could just hit the ball a country mile. Both good guys, but you say the wrong kind of leadership for that team. Why?
Good guys and funny guys, well-liked. Nobody had any problem, per se, with the way they conducted themselves. But because they were stars, they were powerful, they had gaudy numbers, made a lot of money, were on television all the time and in the headlines, the younger players naturally looked up to them as leaders. And for all their assets on a ball club, they didn't purport to be leaders. They both had body language that wasn't particularly energetic. In Griffey's case, he was advanced in age and dealing with a lot of injuries, and he couldn't play as at the breakneck speed that he did when he was young. Dunn is a big guy. He played with injuries also. And he's has a sort of a good old boy pace about him. Maybe the funniest ball player I've ever encountered. His teammates appreciated that. But they didn't set a tone of energy and urgency for the younger players.
Which one of these guys had the recliner next to his locker?
Oh, both of them did. That was okay. Became a Griffey and Dunn both like to relax in the locker room and you know, just let their hair down before a game and prepare in their own way. And they did have reclining chairs. They had recliners in the locker room. And it became an issue in Cincinnati, referred to by some as Reclinergate. And people thought it did set the wrong tone, that it was a lazy team. They were lying around and not preparing. And that was their way of doing things.
Right. So two guys who produce good numbers and have certainly earned the right maybe to take a break now and then. But if the younger players are looking up to somebody who is not filled with energy, that's not what we need in a clubhouse leader. What do you need?
The curious thing about it is that it's like a chemical mix. Depending on what the other elements are, that the product result can be so different. The Cincinnati Red that I used most often as an example of being a good teammate and setting example was Scott Rolen. And yet, having come from the Cardinals, he had been on the outs with his manager there, Tony La Russa, and he'd had some issues to that effect in an earlier stop in Philadelphia. He wasn't considered a particularly good baseball citizen. But when he arrived in Cincinnati as a no-nonsense veteran, he led the way and really changed the makeup of the ball team. And younger players rallied around that and respected it. You know, put a player in a different situation and he may not have the same effect at all.
You write that the great player Jack Clark once said that everybody should have the benefit of playing 1 year with Joe Morgan. I mean, older folks will remember Joe Morgan as the second baseman for the Cincinnati Reds back in the 70s. What was special about what Joe Morgan brought to a team?
In Cincinnati, he was part of a great foursome with Tony Perez, Pete Rose, and Johnny Bench that were sort of famous for their needling. One of my favorite anecdotes of the book was in 1975 when the Reds were struggling early in the year. They had a losing record, and they were known for needling in the clubhouse, and the manager, Sparky Anderson, thought it might be excessive. And so he told them to cut back on it, no more needling, just take it easy with the young players on the team. And it wasn't working. And they were losing. They weren't having much fun. Morgan got hurt one day, went in, went to the doctor, reported to the ballpark the next day. He just simply had enough. And he walked into the clubhouse and looked around and said, "Screw you, Rose. Screw you, Bench. Screw you, Perez." And then Sparky Anderson is standing there, and he turns around and says, "Well, I'm at it. Screw you too, Sparky." And from that point on, the Reds, I posted, I think it was like a 750 winning percentage. You know, anecdotal, who knows, you know, how much effect that really had, but it was a dramatic turnaround point for the Reds that season, and for the Big Red Machine, which of course, in those 2 years, won back-to-back World Series. What Morgan did was say, "Let's cut it loose, guys. Let's be us," and it worked.
We began by talking about the Cincinnati Reds when they had a couple of great players who didn't bring enough energy to the clubhouse, weren't the right kind of leaders. The team eventually traded them away and got different players. Who provided the leadership, and why did it work?
Scott Rolen was probably the principal leader, and Walt Jocketty traded for him specifically for that purpose. It was an odd trade when the Reds acquired Rolen because they were a young, struggling team. It was a mid-season trade. A team like that doesn't usually deal for a veteran. They're usually jettisoning their veterans to rebuild with younger players, and so Jocketty, in sort of a backward step, traded young players for a veteran on the decline, understanding that what he would bring to the team would be a veteran presence that would instruct the younger players. And it worked.
Lonnie Wheeler is the author of the new book, Intangible: The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games. We're going to listen to the interview Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with actress Allison Brie. Brie was in two TV series at the same time, each with a devoted following. On Mad Men, she was Trudy Campbell, the wife of Pete Campbell, who became one of Don Draper's ad agency partners. On the acclaimed and frequently canceled series Community, Bree played Annie, one of the students in the community college study group. Allison Brie's been in the films Get Hard, The Lego Movie, and The 5-Year Engagement. Now she's starring in the new film Sleeping with Other People, directed by Leslie Headland. Sleeping with Other People starts with Brie's character Lainey still in college. She has a one-night stand with Jake, played by Jason Sudeikis, and on that night they each lose their virginity. Over a decade later, they run into each other again and find they're in a similar predicament. They've both become serial cheaters who can't sustain a long-term relationship. After the two of them go on one date, they decide they should keep it platonic since they're just so bad at relationships.
We gotta just be friends.
Yes, that is the mature, responsible thing to do for each other and ourselves. Yes, I agree. Okay, but then we gotta come up with a system. If we're gonna be friends, you know, and I want it to be good friends, but we gotta
it's
have
fair.
A system here.
So maybe we come up with a safe word for if we're having sexual tension, and then we'll stop
whatever
is creating.
So you're doing something sexy, or I'm doing something sexy.
We're feeling attracted.
Okay, but it's mutual, so it is mutual.
The word.
You're saying it's mutual.
It could be mutual.
That's a yes.
I may or
That's
may not need
yes.
to use the word. We'll have to see in
okay,
the future.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, let's.
What
all right.
Say,
we'll safe
say,
word.
Yeah,
let's go.
Anything.
Come up with one. What do you got? I'll do anything. What do you? What you pick it and yes.
It's avocado.
No, can't do that.
No.
No. No.
It's just immediate veto.
Mm-mm. Well, I mean, it's too sexual. It's too sexual.
Avocado is too sexual.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, you got to see the way I eat an avocado. You'd be like. That's, do that to me.
Allison Brie, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The film is about adults who have problems with love and sex and relationships. And, you know, there is adult content in this. And I read that some of the sex scenes in the script originally were more explicit than they ended up being. And mm-hmm. you said that that was something that was interesting to you just because it was different and also because it was a female director and writer, so maybe you can feel a little bit safer. Why was the edgier mm-hmm. content something that was interesting to you?
Well, the characters that I've played to this point, mostly Annie and Trudy, are a bit more conservative. Trudy, just because of her era, not just because of, I don't think Trudy would be sleeping around all the time. When I read this script, immediately, I was drawn to the sexuality of this character, and knowing that Leslie had written it and was going to direct it, it felt like a safe way to explore that new ground. We had a lot of discussions about how the sex scenes would be shot before my contract was done. You know, you have to do a whole nudity writer and all that kind of stuff. So we had a lot of discussions about that stuff, and it definitely felt like a safe environment to get into that. Leslie is very, very anti-nudity in her sex scenes, which I find totally interesting.
Do you know why that is? I heard that you seemed more okay with it than she did.
I didn't want to inhibit the scenes at all, so that was more where I was coming from. I wasn't like, I'm dying to show my breasts. You know, I think it was more like, I'd rather not be nude, but I'd want the scenes to feel organic. I don't want it to seem like I'm weirdly wearing a shirt when he's totally naked or, you know, something like that. I didn't want there to be an imbalance. And she had said something to me about how she just doesn't love nudity. She finds it distracting for an audience. And I get that it sort of can take you out of it. The sex scenes in this movie are like musical numbers in a musical, I feel like, where, yes, we're singing and dancing, but only so that we can continue to move the story forward, to move the plot forward, so you can have a deeper understanding of who these people are, versus, oh, Allison Brie is showing her boobs for the first time in this scene. Oh, my God, we're looking at her boobs, you know, which may happen one day. I don't know. But for now, it seemed nice to let the audience stay in the world of the characters. And also, it did seem a bit more realistic.
Now, a lot of our listeners know you from your role as Trudy Campbell from Mad Men. How did you get that role, and what were you doing acting-wise at the time?
I had recently graduated from college, not that recently, but recently enough that I was still living at home with my mom. And at the time, I was doing theater. I was doing Hamlet at the Rubicon Theater in Ventura County, and I auditioned for Mad Men, and the show had been picked up to series, but no episodes had aired yet at that point. So I really didn't have a point of reference except for the script. And I just, you knew it was good. The script was good. And I felt really strongly that I was going to get the part. And I went in and auditioned for just the casting directors. And I got called back to come in for Matt Weiner and the director of the episode and a few producers. And I remember feeling great about it. Like, I know I'm going to get this. And about 2 weeks went by. I was back up in Ventura, and I was so crushed because 2 weeks is an eternity in TV. Everything gets made so fast, and it normally would mean that you definitely didn't get the part. Maybe it was just under 2 weeks, but it was a while because they actually ended up, Matt told me later that they had a whole nother casting session, and then they were down to the wire and needed to cast the part, and it was Matt who kind of went back and was like, where's that Brie girl? Find the tape for that Brie girl. And then I got the call.
In those early seasons, I always felt like Trudy was, you know, of the company wives, she was the best one. You know, she knew who to talk to at a party. She knew what she was supposed to do to help Pete sort of advance in his career. She knew she was supposed to have the bosses over for dinner. And I want to play a quick scene from season 5. Trudy really wants Don and Megan, his wife at the time, to come over for dinner at their house in the suburbs. So Don wants to cancel. He kind of wants to get out of it. So he gives Trudy a call. Don, obviously, played by John Hamm. And here you are. You're on the phone. You're feeding your daughter in the background.
Trudy, I'm glad I got a hold of you. I have some bad news.
No, you don't. We're building the whole party around you.
You see, I'm afraid we're not free.
Don, do you want to go down your list of excuses and I'll combat each one individually? Or should we just skip to the end? If you can't make it Saturday, I will reschedule. It's going to happen, and I promise you'll have a good time.
It's too bad your husband can't close a deal like this.
We both know he's doing just fine. 7:30.
That's a scene from Mad Men. Is that how you saw Trudy as this great company wife, you know, who also had ambitions herself?
Had ambitions herself, but just in that supportive way, I think, of her husband. I think all of her ambitions were funneled through Pete and geared towards him. I mean, I love that even in that scene, she won't allow Pete to be criticized. It's like, no, this isn't about, you know, don't even say I'm better than him because we're a team and he's great and I'm also great. People have referred to Trudy as a Lady Macbeth type character, and that I love. Love that analogy, and I couldn't agree more. I think it's very true that she has some of that to her where she wants to be the one steering the ship behind the scenes, but she's really the one in charge. But we also see over the seasons the power kind of shift back and forth between the two of them.
Now, I read that you had the option to become a regular on Mad Men, meaning you would only do that show and you'd had to be ready to shoot whether they needed you or not. And you decided to turn that down. Why did you make that decision at the time?
Well, I was about to test for another show. It was prior to Community. I didn't book that show. But it was really my first time sort of doing pilot season, which as an actor, a lot of actors in LA that during pilot season go out for tons of shows and then they test at the network level and they test at the studio level. And it's this huge thing that happens every year. I had never really experienced it. Mad Men was one of my first jobs ever. It was my second job ever on television. And I loved working on Mad Men so much, but I think I felt like the character would always be someone's wife. It's such a large ensemble on that show that I sort of felt like, I don't know how much more they would even be able to do with me. Like, so it seemed like a silly decision to give them full control of my schedule for about the same amount of money when I could do that at the same time and have some freedom to do other things. And then Community came up so quickly that I think we didn't even have time to kind of run it by the folks over at Mad Men. I don't think that went over too well, but luckily all of the producers on Community were big Mad Men fans. So they were pretty open about letting me continue to recur over there, which is, it's not unprecedented, but normally with the contracts that you sign as a regular on a network show like NBC or CBS or ABC, they limit the amount of guest star appearances you can do to 2 or 3 or 1. Mm-hmm. So every year we did have to ask permission from NBC, and sometimes it was more difficult and sometimes it was a little easier. But every year that I was working on Community, we did have to kind of get their approval for me to keep going back over to Mad Men.
Well, at the end of the show's run, Matt Weiner, the creator of Mad Men, he didn't do that many interviews, but he did talk a little bit to the press. And someone asked him who he would want to check in with decades later, like who he would want to have coffee with. And he said Trudy Campbell. Did that surprise you, or did that, or did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, he said, quote, or at least I think, quote, I just think she'd be a dynamite old lady. Does that surprise you?
I couldn't agree more. Or how does that make you feel? It doesn't surprise me at all. It makes me feel great. It does not surprise me at all. Trudy is a great character. And I think all along when we were shooting the series that Matt was always pulling from people he knew, qualities from his parents, his friends' parents, and other people growing up. It's wonderful to hear that she had a special place in his heart. She is a dynamite character.
We're listening to the interview that Fresh Air producer Anne-Marie Baldonado recorded with Alison Brie, who stars in the new movie Sleeping with Other People. Brie played Trudy Campbell in Mad Men. On the comedy series Community, she played Annie, a student in a community college study group. Here she is in the first season talking to a professor played by John Oliver.
Professor Duncan! Professor Duncan! Annie Edison, I'm in your 101 lecture.
Hello.
I've heard about your special psych lab.
Ah, the Duncan principle.
Yes, and I know it's limited to second year students, but I had a 4.0 at Riverside High, and I'm not looking down on this school at all, but mm-hmm. I'm only here because of a brief addiction to pills that I was told would help me focus, but they actually made me lose my scholarship and virginity.
Right.
If you would let me take your lab early, it would be a real feather in my transcript.
Now, while you were doing Mad Men, you're obviously also on this other huge, a show where the fans are totally rabid of Community. And there were times where you're shooting both shows at the same time. Was it weird going back and forth on these two shows? Did you ever have to shoot on the same day? Or is that something that all actors do, sort of go from one job to another?
There were only probably a couple days that I shot on the same day because that's crazy. I don't think a lot of people do it. There are other actors who work on two shows, so I can't really speak to what their schedules are like. But it definitely felt kind of crazy in the moment, especially because over at Community, our hours were very long and the characters were usually all together. It was very seldom that storylines were broken up and having characters just in twos and threes. It was like the whole study group together all the time. To me, those days were just very exciting. It was really exciting. These were my first two big jobs. They're still my two biggest jobs. And it felt like how I had always imagined in my romanticized version of being a working actress, what it would feel like, you know? Gotta dash off to my other job, get back into hair and makeup. Now I'm a totally different character. It was exciting.
Now, Community, at least on paper, sort of started out as kind of a take on workplace comedy, you know, like a group of diverse people together at a community college. Mm-hmm. And then it sort of became this like odd magical show that was super meta. When you first saw the script, or when you guys first started making the show, did it feel that odd? You know what I mean? Like, did the meta stuff sort of come as you guys started making more episodes?
Yes, definitely. The pilot episode was pretty straightforward, and I was drawn to it. Joel was attached. Chevy Chase was involved. It was incredibly well written, but it wasn't until maybe about the 6th episode of the show that things started to really gel with the cast and with the writers, and then they started to get real weird. And also, I think there's like a trial period. It's a new show. I'm sure Dan was very aware of writing a show.
Dan Harmon, the creator.
Yes, mm-hmm. to appease a network, a show that a network is going to like and want to keep on the air that feels accessible. And the show was sort of initially accepted by NBC, though never adored. Then I think just more and more of Dan started to seep into the show.
So you grew up in South Pasadena.
Yes.
What was it like growing up there? Because, you know, it's Southern California, so you're sort of closer to the TV and film industry. Does living, you know, in close proximity make acting seem like a more attainable career?
I think so, yes. Well, one, my father worked as an entertainment journalist, and also he's a musician, and he's a singer-songwriter and was always writing music and performing. So there was that sort of artistic thing happening in our family all the time, and me sort of being like, oh, you know, my father dropped out of law school to be a musician. So that's an acceptable thing to do, just already as an example in my own family. But also in South Pasadena, because it looks like it could be anywhere in the U.S., it looks like a very quaint small town. A lot of movies are shot there. So while Hollywood wasn't on my radar as a kid, like, I definitely didn't want to act until I was an adult. I wanted to go to high school and go to college and then start working. You know, I do remember when I was in middle school walking home and they were shooting this movie called Bye Bye Love that stars Matthew Modine and Paul Reiser.
Oh.
Some AD, you know, some assistant stopped me and, like, paid me $10 to use my binder in the movie. He, like, bought my folder from me. And it was exciting. I remember feeling excited. Wow, they're shooting that movie down the street at next to Sarah's house. And my binder is going to be in that movie. It just sort of was a cool thing. At my high school, they had shot the original Halloween there. And you could see my locker. There were cool things like that. They shot Old School right down the street from my high school. So we would occasionally, like, drive past the Old School house. You know, the actor that played Steve Urkel went to my high school before I went there. And so did, you know, they shot the Beethoven movies, you know, the ones about the dog.
Mm-hmm.
That mythology was all there. You'd hear these stories about people acting and doing that kind of stuff. So it seemed like it was within reach.
Allison Brie speaking with Fresh Air producer Anne Marie Baldonado. Brie stars in the new film, Sleeping with Other People. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.